This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we find ourselves as a nation once again grappling with another terrible tragedy. Another gunman opened fire, this time in a Florida school. That mass shooting left 17 people dead, mostly students, but also some brave teachers who shielded the fleeing students from the bullets.
Well, Mark, all of us in healthcare have had to look at the gun violence epidemic for what it is, and it is a public health crisis. We know that guns in the home increase the likelihood of accidental death or suicide, but also homicide. We do risk assessments in our clinical practice to help us understand who may be at risk in their own homes, but we are up against an incredibly formidable foe. There are just too many guns in circulation in this country, more than 300 million, and they are simply too easy to obtain. This is a daunting problem.
We had our own troubling experience with this issue here in our own home state of Connecticut after the Sandy Hook shootings. Our behavioral health clinicians helped families grieving through the aftermath of that tragedy, and we watched bewildered as nothing changed in Washington in response to Sandy Hook. But I think this time the tide may be changing. The teen survivors of the Florida shooting have begun a grassroots movement to promote rational gun laws. And their numbers are growing across the country. Their voices are being heard. And hopefully, this tragedy will yield more meaningful results.
Well, Mark, I don't think anyone in the country can fail to be moved by those kids standing up and saying, no more. We need to do something about this. And we have to do better as healthcare providers, to say nothing of as a nation as a whole. We have to mitigate the toll that's being exacted by gun violence on people. It's going to take some innovative approaches. It's going to take some legislative approaches. And it's going to take some serious political will.
You're absolutely right. And speaking of innovations, it's something our guest today is fully engaged in. Peter O'Neill is the executive director of Cleveland Clinic Innovations, which is the commercialization arm of the Cleveland Clinic, dedicated to getting their breakthrough technologies to the marketplace.
Looking forward to that conversation, Mark. And Lori Robertson, of course, will be checking in with us, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's looking at misstatements spoken about health and health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Peter O'Neill of the Cleveland Clinic Innovations in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Department of Health and Human Services issued a proposed rule on short-term health insurance plans for those in the insurance marketplace, allowing for short-term plans that can be purchased for up to 12 months. But Larry Levitt of the Kaiser Family Foundation says these plans are no panacea. They're not required to cover much of what is required by the Affordable Care Act, not the so-called 10 essential benefits, not pre-existing conditions or maternity care, preventive care, or prescription drug benefits. Even analysis from HHS shows that plans such as these, which might appeal to younger, healthier people, would likely take them out of the insurance marketplace pool, leading to higher premiums for those who remain in the marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act. Insurance industry experts caution this move will serve to further destabilize the insurance marketplace and impact the medically and financially vulnerable the most. The rule is open for comments. There's been a tsunami of comments about guns, violence, and public health since the latest mass shooting at an American school, and the tide may be turning on the topic. The president and members of the GOP are responding to a rising tide of criticism over lack of action on gun control in the wake of the epidemic of gun violence in this country. Some gun control measures on the table, increased background checks for gun buyers. There's also mounting pressure on state and federal lawmakers to take action on the matter. And Democrats in Congress are calling for a repeal of the Dickey Amendment, which barred use of tax dollars for research on the effects of gun violence on public health. Meanwhile, students seem to be taking the lead. They convened a large group in Florida state capital, Tallahassee, to advocate for stricter gun controls. They're also planning a big march March 24th against gun violence across the country. Meanwhile, the president focused initially on the mental health of the latest shooter who had numerous run-ins with school and local law enforcement officials and whose violent tendencies were reported more than once to the police. The president's last two budget proposals call for a reduction in mental health services funding. Turning the tide, the flu season seems to have plateaued in recent weeks. Numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show that visits to the ER and clinicians' offices for flu-related symptoms has tapered a bit, although it hasn't dropped dramatically yet. The CDC saying this year's flu vaccine was about 36% effective against this year's strain of the flu, which was particularly deadly. Adults who got the flu shot had a 36% less likely chance of getting the flu, but the effect was more protective in children. About 60% of kids who got the vaccine had a better protective effect against acquiring flu. Pneumonia and flu-related deaths rose sharply in the first weeks of 2018, accounting for about 10% of all deaths during the week ending January 20th. And the U.S. Surgeon General is urging folks who haven't yet been vaccinated to still get the flu shot, which he says is the only hedge right now against contracting the disease. We know the human toll of the opioid epidemic, now the leading cause of accidental death, some 64,000 dying. But according to a recent study, the opioid epidemic has cost the U.S. economy some $1 trillion since 2001. And the recent acceleration of the crisis and higher numbers of those suffering from opioid use disorder will see those numbers increase. A report compiled by the nonprofit research group Alterum points to lost wages and productivity due to addiction and early death as the biggest driver in that economic toll, followed by state and local budgets being hammered by law enforcement and increased health costs related to the opioid epidemic. And there's no immediate end in sight. The report predicts the cost over the next 3 years will top the $500 billion mark as the numbers of those affected continues to rise. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Peter O'Neill, Executive Director of the Cleveland Clinic Innovations, the commercialization arm of the Cleveland Clinic, whose mission is to bring technological breakthroughs being developed by clinicians into the healthcare marketplace. Founded in 2000, Cleveland Clinic Innovations has already brought hundreds of products to the healthcare marketplace. Mr. O'Neill has been with CCI for 10 years, previously serving as Senior Commercialization Officer. Prior to joining Cleveland Clinic, he was Deputy Director of Battelle's Great Lakes Industrial Technology Center. He earned his BS in Aeronautical Science at MIT. Pete, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me and that kind introduction.
I wonder if you could share with our listeners more about the mission at Cleveland Clinic Innovations and how it's designed to interface with the Cleveland Clinic Health Systems to bring these innovations from bench to bedside more easily.
So like everyone at the Cleveland Clinic, the members of the innovations team, we are employees of the health system. You know, we don't treat patients directly. That being said, like every employee of the Cleveland Clinic, we think of ourselves as caregivers. The way we think about that is we help patients by working with our inventors to translate their ideas into products that help patients. That's how we think about our highest level mission is ultimately about helping patients. We do work with Cleveland Clinic employees throughout the health system. So that is mostly the employees here in Cleveland, but it does include employees in Florida, Las Vegas, Abu Dhabi, and soon to be London. Most of our innovations come from our doctors, as you can imagine, but we also receive many inventions from nurses, our researchers, people that work in facilities, people that work on our IT technology projects. So really open to working with caregivers all across the system. And we support all phases of commercializing products. And you mentioned it, marketplace. You know, that is a real emphasis for us, is bringing products to the marketplace.
Well, Pete, I am reminded, listening to you, of our interview with the just-retired Cleveland Clinic CEO, Dr. Toby Cosgrove. He talked about the Cleveland Clinic's philosophy about innovation, and I remember him saying, every clinician should have an opportunity to promote their potentially disruptive ideas in healthcare and healthcare delivery, and that the entire ecosystem is really designed to support innovation in that way. I know that the Cleveland Clinic Innovations has already launched hundreds of patents entrance into the marketplace spun off a number of startups. And I think our listeners would be really fascinated to hear about some of the more notable products that have been developed at CCI that maybe we now think of as just part of the larger landscape.
Well, you mentioned Toby, who is not only a great leader of the Cleveland Clinic, he also happens to be the most prolific inventor in our history. He was a world-renowned cardiovascular surgeon, and he was instrumental in bringing a number of heart valves to the marketplace that have been used in help treat more than 100,000 patients to date. So, and Toby, on his own, but also through his leadership role, is part of promoting that innovative culture at the Cleveland Clinic. You know, many of our inventions are captured in companies. Recently, one of our companies, Cleveland Heart Lab, was recently acquired by Quest Diagnostics, and the technologies in that company are being used to build a Center for Cardiovascular Inflammation Diagnostics here in Cleveland. So, you know, we're proud of both the technical and market impact of that, but also there's the regional economic impact of that, of the story of Cleveland Heart Lab. Similarly, Intellect, another one of our companies was acquired, did some pioneering work in deep brain stimulation. But as I mentioned earlier, we also have technologies from others of our caregivers. So right now, one of our more interesting projects we're working on was developed by one of our nurses. Recognize that in the operating room, you know, doctors have many layers of non-breathable protective gowns that they wear. It's hot. Even though the rooms are kept reasonably cool, the doctors and some of the, you know, surgeons can be doing a surgery for many hours, and it's, you know, fatigue is important to try to manage. And so she developed a cooling vest to help these surgeons get through their procedure and to stay, you know, as focused as possible on their patient. As you said, we've got hundreds of products that have gotten to the marketplace from our caregivers.
Pete, we were reading Healthcare Informatics, and it noted that Cleveland is the next hot spot to watch for innovations in the healthcare space. And most folks usually think of Silicon Valley when they're considering where the disruption is coming from. And I wonder if you could talk about the unique approach at CCI that is helping put Cleveland on the map. And, you know, I have a good friend who's a CEO of a genomics company down in Stanford near New York, and he tells me that he can't get any Google engineers to travel north of Chelsea's Market in Manhattan. So tell us how you're able to get folks to come to Cleveland, or are you bringing some folks in virtually as well?
I do think an ingredient of what Cleveland and Cleveland Clinic bring is a very collaborative perspective on business. We frequently interact with companies that want to connect with the thought-leading clinicians here at the Cleveland Clinic. You know, Cleveland Clinic, we're all employees. It's a single group practice. As a result, we have tremendous access to large amounts of data. And another role that Cleveland Clinic Innovations is collaborations that help facilitate access to that data. And I've personally been involved in some work where people were able to go back into those data sets and do some data mining and effectively do some retrospective studies in a very, very cost-efficient kind of way, because they didn't need to enroll any new patients. You could really review patient files and really understand data sets. I think Cleveland is sometimes underappreciated for its pipeline of talent. We think very well of the universities that are here in town and have great connection to them as sources of talent. I saw the CEO of Exploris, which was another one of our companies acquired, that was acquired by IBM. He talked about being in Cleveland as a real asset because of the access to talent. You know, you can't talk about being here without, in the comparison to Silicon Valley, without at least mentioning cost. When you're starting a company, and even, you know, heck, even companies, I think you mentioned Google. I mean, even Google, you know, their salary costs are non-trivial, and, you know, the salaries and other costs of doing business here in Cleveland are just that much less than places like Boston and San Francisco. An early stage or any entrepreneur is making a mistake if they don't at least consider growing their business in Cleveland.
Well, I think the mayor of Cleveland thanks you, and that's a great plug for the city of Cleveland. And yeah, I want to talk about this continuum of ideas to cost, and I think we couldn't agree with you more that the people closest to the patients are likely to be the most inspired, and it's incredible to have an incubator to actually take things to the point where they're in the market or at the bedside or in the home of the patient, wherever. And you need a pretty robust infrastructure for capital investment, product development. I think, again, our listeners would be really interested to hear how the Cleveland Clinic manages to fund so much development, and how does your venture division work to support all this innovation work? It's an unusual model.
You know, I think we do not think of the event of creating company as a metric of success. You know, we could very, very easily and quickly decide that we're going to form a company. Instead, we do a lot of very rigorous internal diligence to challenge whether an opportunity should have a spin-off company. Once you form a company, you introduce additional modes that can cause that product to fail. And so we've had some very successful projects. I mean, I mentioned Dr. Cosgrove's valves. I mean, those were done through a direct license and not through a startup. So I think step one is to be rigorous about deciding to start companies at all. With regard to funding, the way we think of it is de-risking. So we have funding that we apply in the sort of $5,000 to $50,000 range to do some early stage prototyping. If a project achieves the right kind of success there, then we have some different sources of funding to maybe $500,000 range. And then, you know, we have the ability to access millions of dollars. Of course, we prefer projects to be successful and to advance through those phases, but we recognize that not all projects are going to be successful. So we, you know, I think the expression is fail fast. And so that's why we designed our prototyping and other early stage projects to give us that decisive answer about whether a project is going to be successful in the marketplace.
We're speaking today with Peter O'Neill, Executive Director of Cleveland Clinic Innovations, the commercialization arm of the Cleveland Clinic, whose mission is to bring technological breakthroughs being developed by its clinicians into the health marketplace. Pete, you've not only focused on product development within your own organization, the Cleveland Clinic also puts out a list every year of the top 10 products or technologies that are bound to disrupt healthcare. They must be innovative and they must have the capacity to change care in a major way. And I'm sure all of our listeners are interested in hearing what your predictions were for 2018 and also the process that you go about in picking those top 10 healthcare breakthroughs each year.
We do something on the order of 200 interviews. Most of those are with Cleveland Clinic employees. We do include some external people as well. We're always interested in the perspectives of the marketplace. That led to about 110 ideas, discussed every one of those ideas in detail, and it's an impressive process. And every year, I'm incredibly appreciative of the time and investment and energy that our caregivers give us to support that project. I think you asked about predictions for 2018.
Everybody loves predictions.
You know, I think last year there were a couple projects that were discussed that were concluded were not quite ready. We look for projects that are going to have impact within the next calendar year. So sometimes we say, hey, this is maybe a year or two away. You know, some of the projects in remote health management and artificial intelligence are on our radar. There's a balance between waiting too long and feeling like, oh, it's yesterday's news versus saying it too early, but those are definitely innovations that we're keeping track of.
moving beyond Cleveland and even the United States, we've been watching the degree to which the Cleveland Clinic is casting its influence all around the world, opening institutions in Canada, in the UK, Abu Dhabi. I hear this talk of a collaboration with China. I don't know if that's gotten underway yet. And this also goes back to our conversation with Toby Cosgrove. It was clear it was not just about bricks and mortar, but also about really bringing the model of care, the healthcare delivery model, to communities and countries to provide better healthcare for people and raise the bar in healthcare overall. Also about expanding maybe some of the telehealth protocols and using these international hubs as a way to improve clinician training around the country in an increasing global marketplace. So talk with us about this expanding scope of Cleveland Clinic, and how do you think all of that work around the world is going to have an impact back at home at Cleveland Clinic Innovations?
Sure. The U.S. healthcare market is obviously a huge part of the worldwide market. That being said, it's not the whole market. And so we very much appreciate our ability through our foreign hospitals to get direct insights into the way other parts of the world deliver healthcare. What that does for us is, as we think about the types of technologies that can be embraced here in the United States and other places in the world, we bring those additional perspectives to help us evaluate technology. Historically, we've evaluated technologies on sort of three criteria: patentability, market size, clinical effectiveness. A fourth and growing influence for us is value, and ultimately that sort of gets distilled into cost. And I think some foreign markets have some really strong ways of delivering value, lower cost solutions to their patients. You know, we recently established this collaboration with the Silicon Valley-based accelerator Plug and Play. They're going to be opening an office here in Cleveland. That is a direct benefit to us, is to getting Plug and Play's global network of viewing startups in all different kinds of parts of healthcare, delivering filtered lists of those companies to us to look at. And so we're really excited about that. We announced that collaboration in October. The first event here in Cleveland is happening March 1st. So, that's an exciting way for us to continue to have a worldwide reach.
You know, Pete, that also picks up on the collaboration that we've talked about on the show before with Apple, Stanford Health, and American Well, a sort of a first of its kind health arrhythmia study, looking to use Apple Watch users and scale up that research. And so you've got your own sort of world-class collaboration going on. And this seems to me an emerging trend that I'm wondering how you think this will be helpful in bringing disruptive health technologies to the marketplace sooner. Do you see this as a roadmap for the future of how these collaborations might bring about better value to patients and to populations?
I do, and you mentioned that the moving away from bricks and mortar, and you think about companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM. You know, these are all companies that have successfully disrupted other markets. They're looking at healthcare. We know that. I mean, it seems like almost every week I see some story about some non-traditional healthcare company getting involved in healthcare. And we collaborate with lots of those companies. And that's exciting for us because we know that's a necessary direction for healthcare. Cost, value, convenience, patients. Cleveland Clinic's main campus is amazing, but a patient, if they can stay home and get diagnosed at home, that's still better. When you talk about managing the wellness of patients, that really should be done in a remote setting. And so, yes, all of this, you used the word disruption, and you nailed it. That's exactly what's coming, and I think those kinds of companies that's exactly why we enjoy working with them.
We've been speaking today with Peter O'Neill, Executive Director of Cleveland Clinic Innovations, the commercialization arm of the Cleveland Clinic, whose mission is to bring technological breakthroughs being developed by its clinicians into the healthcare market. You can learn more about their work by going to clevelandclinic.org or follow them on Twitter at Cleveland Clinic. Pete, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you both for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump distorted the facts about a protest in the United Kingdom regarding the universal healthcare system there. Trump tweeted that while Democrats are pushing for universal health care, quote, thousands of people are marching in the UK because their system is going broke and not working. But the London demonstrators marched in support of the system and urged the government to better fund it. The United Kingdom's National Health Service is a single-payer system. The government pays for health care, which is free at the point of service, with the exception of some prescription, eye care, or dental costs, and funded through taxes. Trump's tweet suggests those demonstrating were opposed to that universal health care system. That's not accurate. The BBC reported that thousands demonstrated in London on February 3rd, quote, calling for more government support for the NHS. The groups behind the rally put out a joint statement responding to Trump's tweet. They said the demonstrators wanted, quote, to show their love for the principles of universal and comprehensive care free at the point of use. They were protesting, they said, against British government policies they view as trying to, quote, move us more to an American-style system. In February, the New York Times wrote about budgetary austerity in the UK that had limited the growth of health spending to below the historical norm. As a result, patients can wait months for procedures, though public satisfaction with NHS remains high. The protesters in the UK carried signs that read, "More staff, more beds, more funds," and "Save our NHS." As for Democrats in the US, some are pushing for universal health care. Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a Medicare for All Act last fall, co-sponsored by 16 Democrats, and a majority of House Democrats were co-sponsors of a Medicare for All bill in that chamber last year. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to the research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, and left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress, in some cases lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
And it was a typical kind of Hatha yoga that would include physical postures, breathing exercises, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
So we found that women, on average, were reporting that they were reporting much less. Women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms, helping them successfully navigate those symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.